The Life of Gustavus Adolphus, Duchess Christina, Part 2, and the Rise of Karl. Now, Johann III was informed that the now despised fiancée of his son had neither wit nor beauty. Now, the judgment stands in irreconcilable opposition to the opinion of Axel Oxenstierna that she was in person fair and of good nature, in her mind and spirit lofty and noble. Her father, the Duke Adolf of Holstein-Gottorp, the founder of one of the most famous dynasties in the history of the North, had made a name for himself as a valiant prince and patron of the arts. He was a man whose restlessness was abated only by old age, a Nordic type of Renaissance man, full of joy of living and with strong taste for beautiful but not very firm convictions on matters of religion. From her mother's family, on the other hand, Christina had inherited a strong tradition of theological seriousness of the Reformation era. Indeed, the estimable and upright duchess whose name she bore was herself the daughter of Philip the Magnanimous of Hesse, who had been a friend of Luther and Melanchthon. Such an ancestry necessarily exerted a powerful influence upon Karl and his young wife. Hesse stood in the forefront of that wing of German Protestantism to which Karl early felt himself inclining. The group which may be called the Party of Action, whose distinguishing feature in history was perhaps its vacillation between the Lutheran and Reformed confessions. Prominent in its ranks was the Palatine House, from which Karl had taken his first wife, Maria, herself the granddaughter of Landgraf Philip. Already then, Karl's ecclesiastical policies were friendly towards the Palatinate of Hesse. At this period, each of these states was governed sometimes by Lutheran, sometimes by Calvinist princes, though in both, first in Heidelberg, afterwards at Kassel, Calvinism ultimately obtained the upper hand. It was not long before Karl's Swedish contemporaries suspected him of entertaining purely Calvinist doctrines, an insidious and dangerous accusation in the age when many Lutherans found the road to Rome shorter than the road to Geneva. Karl kept his own counsel as to his religious views, but his standpoint seems to have been not much of that of Calvinism as the expression of a theology which aimed at a general reconciliation between Protestants, while discriminating sharply against all forms of popery. If he were really a Calvinist, he remarked on one occasion, his princely self-respect would compel him to avow it. Nevertheless, he always stood rather nearer to Calvin than to Luther. It was therefore all the more inevitable that his theological opinions should widen the breach between himself and convince the adherents of the Counter-Reformation, his nephew Sigismund. When on December the 9th, 1594, Gustav Adolf was born in the castle at Stockholm, at the time the residence of his parents, Sigismund's marriage had not been blessed with an heir. Just 6 months afterwards, there was born in Krakow a prince, Waldislaw. The succession in both lines seemed secure, and between these two almost contemporary scions of the House of Vasa, there stood also, in virtue of the succession agreement, Sigismund's half-brother, Duke Johann, who at the time of Wendislaw's birth was 6 months old. Karl, on numerous occasions, solemnly disavowed any intention of deviating from the succession agreement, and he continued to manifest scruples in this respect even after Sigismund's deposition. Fundamentally, despite his resort to revolution, he was a legitimist, above all where the House of Vasa was concerned. He stood stiffly upon his own right as hereditary prince, yet it is scarcely to be wondered at if the doubtful prospects which lay ahead should have awakened in him and his wife the hope that their eldest son might one day be destined to ascend the throne of Sweden. At all events, it is clear that the Duke took it hardly when, in the summer of 1595, he received the news of Wendislaw's birth. A form of thanksgiving was drawn up by Erik Spahr and handed over to him to the archbishop to be read from the pulpit. The duke demanded the return of the paper. The original form of thanksgiving had contained a prayer that the prince might grow up to be a blessing on his land and people, and especially the kingdom of Sweden. Karl resolutely struck out the last clause, but ostentatiously added a sentence, obviously under the influence of conflicting feelings, concerning the prince's education in pure evangelical faith. The episode, which is well attested from a contemporary source, throws a flash of light upon his secret thoughts. When Sigismund was deposed, Karl and the Reichstag, which was wholly under his control, offered to receive young Wenceslao into Sweden. It was a scheme that had grown up gradually in Karl's mind during the preceding years of conflict. It can be traced back to the months after the Arboga Reichstag, a full year before Sigismund's disastrous campaign. What the Duke wanted for himself was quite simply the control of the kingdom, not the title of king, as it was his intention that the Prince of Sweden and Poland should be given full regal powers only when he had reached the age of 24. He was in reality reserving himself the direction of affairs for the rest of his lifetime. Even after Sigismund had made it clear that he considered that it was a too high of a price to pay for the retention of his son's rights to succession, Karl hesitated to sever the strand in his policy. At the Reichstag of Linköping, 1600, which completed the revolution and laid the foundation for a new order, the estates were quite prepared to place the crown upon Karl's head. They recognized Gustav Adolf as his eldest son to be the heir to the throne, in preference to Duke Johann as representative of the senior line. But in spite of this fact, the Reichstag resolution, thanks to Karl's intervention, was framed in terms that were decidedly ambiguous. Karl could not bring himself to take a decisive step with regard to either Wenceslao or to Johann. For his part, he compared the resolution to a knot stronger and more complicated than any he had previously contrived, and it proved, in fact, to be an intricate series of knots which had to be unraveled one by one. So next time we'll be looking at the beginning of the unraveling, and it will start with poor little Wenceslao. The sources for this are Gustavus Adolphus versus Wallenstein by Pike, Gustav Adolphus Sweden and the 30 Years' War, 1630-32 by Volk, The Lion of the North by Henty, Gustav Adolphus the Great by Onlund, and Gustav Adolphus and the Rise of Sweden by Roberts, Gustav Adolphus's Army, Part 1, Infantry by Brzezinski, Gustav Adolphus's Army, Part 2, Cavalry by Brzezinski. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise. If you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.